You are listening to the audio-only portion of the KoopaCast. To watch the video version, please check out purenintendo.com/KoopaCast. The intro and outro music of our KoopaCast is brought to you by the artist Big Giant Circles, who has composed for projects such as Mass Effect 2, Super Street Fighter 2 HD Remix, and Borderlands 2. Our opening song is Houston, and our closing song is A Rose in the Field, both from the album Glory Days. To listen to more of Big Giant Circles' work, go to music.biggiantcircles.com to see his entire collection of video game remixes and soundtracks. You can also find his collection on iTunes. Again, that website is music.biggiantcircles.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome to KoopaCast 81, A Valuable Discussion. I am your host, as always, Matt, the Multimedia Manager at PNM and PureNintendo.com, your independent source for all things Nintendo. I am joined by three awesome guests. I am joined by Editor-in-Chief, Justin Sharp.
Good to be here.
I am joined by Writer, Trevor Gould.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in or watching or however you're hearing us. Appreciate it.
And finally, someone who hasn't been here for a very, very long time. In fact, I totally forgot he was on the KoopaCast in the first place. Harrison Milford.
Hi, everybody. It's been about, I think, a year and a half last time I was on here. And for everybody who doesn't know my title, I don't really have a title necessarily. I'm just a contributing writer for the online magazine. So I think it's like December, January issue. I have a piece on there called Extra Life, which I hope all you enjoy reading if you get a chance.
Yes. Yeah, it was the October-November issue, so it's out now, issue 25.
And what timing to talk about the magazine, because we've got another cover reveal coming up soon.
Yes, we do.
Stay tuned to PureNintendo.com for that.
Yeah.
All right, and as you may have guessed by our little topic, our little title that we put in for the KoopaCast, A Valuable Discussion, we're going to be talking about... what makes a game valuable to you? Now, games have various prices. We know it always used to be the standard is $50, $60, or $70. That's usually the range. But now we see games with, you know, $20, $10, $5, or even $1 if you want to go into the mobile stuff. However, as many of us know, games like to exceed, or games can exceed that mere monetary value to us. Some games have a special place in our hearts. Maybe it's nostalgia. Maybe it's pure replay value. Maybe it's just something that scratched that itch that you were looking for in a certain genre. So, with that, without further ado, let's talk about, you know, what are the key, let's just focus on the AAA stuff right now, the $60 deals, the big ones. What do you think is, like, what are you looking for? What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you have, you're at the Best Buy or you're at Amazon.com or whatever, and you've got the game in your hand or in the computer screen, and you go, all right, this is what I want when I put my $60 in.
I would say the one of the biggest things, and it's not always a deal breaker, but I would say the time that I'm going to get out of it, whether, I know a lot of people say like 20 hours is, you're if it's 20 hours or more, you're getting a good return on your $60 investment, you know? But I don't always look at the time, but whether it's replay value or, like, let's say, like, Mario Kart, for instance. I know I'm going to get a ton of replayability. It doesn't have a lot of storyline, you know. I mean, there's no story, really, in Mario Kart. So you're really just getting a lot of replay value from playing when friends come over, playing with family. So I guess, like, replayability is probably a big one, and maybe, you know, the length that a storyline, if any, is in the game.
You go ahead.
No, go ahead, Trevor. I was just about to say I agree with that portion on there, but go ahead.
I think for me, it to some extent probably depends on the genre of game. You know, certain genres, like say like an RPG or like a point and click graphic adventure, if there's a really strong story I can get into. I might be content to have that initial playthrough and then maybe not, you know, go back to a game for a number of years. But for most genres, I tend to, especially if it's a $60 game, you know, which is not, you know, an impulse buy, it's a, you know, a good chunk of change. I like to look for, after I complete the main game, you know, what type of extras are there? Are there unlockable difficulty levels? Are there, you know, some type of, you know, even little bonuses like Miiverse integration or something with Amiibo, something that'll make me come back after I complete, you know, the main story, the main quest. So I kind of play it by ear. I think at least in Nintendo's case with their first party efforts, I always go back to those games anyway because they're high quality. So it's not so much a concern for me with Nintendo, but, you know, with some third party offerings or, you know, or a series or a genre that I'm not overly familiar with, I'm definitely going to do my research ahead of time and see, you know, what it offers me, you know, after the fact.
See, for me, when it comes to like a game, be it if it's a 3DS title at $40 or Wii U or PS4 or Xbox One title at $60. I know, I always call it Xbone. I always have to. But it, to me, it's content. It's always going to be content for it. And when you have other companies that are seemingly giving you a $60 experience or a $60 game, which feels like half finished, and an example of this I'm going to bring on such as a recent game was Star Wars Battlefront. Mm-hmm. The game that feels half finished, but is also trying to nickel and dime you with $50 DLC for the full experience. Now, that seems itself, whatever, not to really get yourself the experience for it's like, oh, this is not worth my time and money, or should I wait for when it's just, you have this game of the year or full edition that most companies like to put out. Nintendo in general seems to be falling different with this trait, like what they did with Splatoon, which was a game that I believe once it was first released, it was about maybe 3/4 complete, possibly. And instead of charging that for, you know, the consumer afterwards, they were able to like, hey, more stuff's on the way. I mean, you can choose to wait or like and get all this stuff for free and then play it there. To me, that's at least on the promise of getting something for a $60 game. Now, if it's even something that's a full complete game, when I say for content, I feel like, you know, like Trevor mentioned to me, is there extra things to go back, you know, bonuses to unlock? Even if those games don't have that on there, if a game has one thing that, and this is one thing a lot of reviewers like to go onto, is replayability. Mm-hmm. If it's a Smash Brothers, Mario Kart, a first-person shooter of be it Call of Duty, or even a classic such as GoldenEye, does this game have enough to last to a point where actually it's like, hey, I'm still going to play this for years to come down the line? And a game that I did play years for a long time, even for a while was on my GameCube, was Metroid Prime. Because even if I wanted to get that extra ending, if it was only 13 seconds, I still went through and replayed the hell out of that game. And yeah, it's a game where it's like, hey, I bought this for $60. Will I still play this in about a month or two, whatever ago, just to revisit? You know, is it entice me to replay it again?
Yeah, and I also think I agree with what Harrison was saying. Part of like the world, you know, we've all kind of gotten our taste of what games we like, you know. I mean, we're, you know, I'm close to 30 years old now. We've been gaming for a while, so.
Join the club.
Yeah. So we know the type of genres that we usually acclimate to. So I can usually tell, you know, based on some gameplay footage, like, yeah, I'm really going to like this game. In the case of Metroid Prime, I remember that was one of my first Metroid experiences. I played a little bit of Super Metroid, but I remember coming into Metroid Prime fairly new on the series and just being completely blown away to the point that, yeah, I've replayed it several times since then, whereas that type of a game, I wouldn't necessarily consider those, you know, replayable in most cases. I would play through it once, and then it's like, okay, I don't really want to play through the single player again, but because the level design and the, I don't know, just the immersion that they did in
the atmosphere was just palpable, essentially.
Yeah, and it was like, it was just such a good experience to relive that again, where some games you're like, okay, I've seen it once, you know, it's got predictable AI, it's, you know, it doesn't have anything very compelling, but, you know, every now and then you have those gems that, you know, are just that compelling, mm-hmm. You have to go back and play. I mean, Zelda games come to mind, you know, with most single player games, you're not going to go back and revisit with a Zelda game. I find myself, you know, 1 year, 2 years down the road, we're playing it for the second or third time. Mm-hmm. So I think it depends on, like Trevor was saying, the genre, but you know, also what type of games you like, the world that they have in there. You know, is it immersive? Is it, you know, is it something that's going to be, you know, fun to come back to?
Yeah, and I hope I'm not maybe jumping ahead on a topic you have, Matt, but just to go along with those comments, I'd prefer to play a shorter game who has terrific content that engages me and compels me versus we've all played games that seemed like they dragged on too long. They had a lot of filler, boring side quests, you know, whatever, grinding, whatever it might be. And, you know, sometimes less is more. I say that a lot. And, you know, content is king, but, you know, if I had to pick between less fun content versus, you know, an 80-hour epic that's, you know, full of padding, I'll go with the shorter experience 9 times out of 10.
Oh, no. And there are experiences where you have such a very less is more experience. I mean, the best example of those is a lot of Platinum Games as titles. Mm-hmm. Like, most of them range into around maybe an 8 or 9 hours to completion, although I think Bayonetta 2 was around 10 hours or so. And even those, for $60 or even 50, whatever, they're worth every penny because you still want to go back for that short level experience. I mean, it, like, just to up your score or try a different difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's such, like Trevor was saying, it's such good content for that, you know, relatively short amount of time in comparison to other games in the genre. It's still, you know, worth going back to. Yeah, and I find that, you know, there's such a glut of open world games nowadays, and there's so many that are, you know, kind of run of the mill, where I'm thinking of mostly Ubisoft open world games where you're like, hey, go to this tall little pinnacle and you've synced up everything around you. Now go and do these little fetch quests, or, you know, look at these little precipices, or hunt these animals, or, you know, like, mm-hmm. if you're playing a Far Cry or Assassin's Creed, they're all pretty run-of-the-mill.
It seems like, you know, things like that where it's open world and Sandbox title as becoming more the, I wouldn't say norm, but just the hot topic of design right now. I mean, we're getting with Xenoblade right now, which is a world that's supposedly bigger than Fallout 4 and Witcher 3 combined, but it just boggles my mind. But of course, you have to have something in that world to make it better. But it just seems like, hey, Sandbox and open world's the new thing. You know, some of these just don't know how to differentiate each other. And I still think to this day, especially Assassin's Creed, which I believe is a series that's running on fumes.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily a bad paradigm. Like, I like a lot of open world games, and I think, I mean, look at the new Zelda. The new Zelda is kind of taking that open world paradigm. They say there's gonna, you know, be their own twist to it, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. But they just have to make the world feel dense and rich, and not, you know, like Trevor said, where you're, you know, have these parts where it's like, oh, this game's going on too long. I don't really need to do this quest, or I don't want to do this fetch quest over here. You know, even some Zelda games had some of that quagmire of fetch quests. So,
don't encourage Matt to get off topic. I just want to say too, we've all seen, and I'm well over 30, so you know, I maybe have my own club here, but we've all seen over the years different genres that, you know, have kind of dominated for a period, whether it's shoot 'em ups or fighters or first person shooters, or, you know, even music games for a while. But, you know, when everything's said and done and we reflect on classics, how many say, oh, I remember this game because it was so long, you know, I remember the game because it was fun. And I think, you know, that's really, you know, bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah, the fun factor, the replayability are really the biggest things that I come back to.
I was trying to think about it, and I don't know if I have the right word or the right phrase, but for me, like, what I'm doing to right now is I want that sense of, like, discovery, and not just, like the, I mean, the best, you know, the most straightforward example, of course, is, like, say, like, Xenoblade Chronicles X, which I'm still playing, you know. Mm. Oh, hey, here's a new cave over here, let's go check it out, you know, or there's this new monster, let's go fight it. Like, that's just, like, that's the bare discovery. But, like, I'm talking, like, if you go deeper, like, try to think back to, say, you know, pre-internet, pre, like, you know, dial-up. Let's go back to nostalgia for a moment, right? When, like, you played a game, there was so much about the game you didn't know, right? Mm-hmm. And then when you discovered that, like, one little thing, you're like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. Like, you know, you got that rush to you because you're like, you used skills or you used what you learned in the game and you found something new and it, like, it just breathed that new life.
I think that was, if I had to say some example of that, was probably the Legend of Zelda: A Link to a Past, was when I got, you know, the three pendants after defeating a three dungeon, I rightfully, my young self who had barely played the first original Zelda, and even, well, I'll have to admit, Zelda 2 was my first Zelda I ever beat, ever, so that's everybody thinks I'm crazy when I think of that, but with A Link to the Past, it's like the thing that I found really great and still why Link to the Past is like regarded as my favorite Zelda title, I like, out of everything, right, out of the series, be it 3D or 2D, is after you find those three pendants and get to the Master Sword, and you're just like, yes, you have seven more dungeons to go. That itself opened it up so much to me, and I was renting this, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to be able to beat this in 3 days. I'm not going to 3D 3 days, and I'm going to have to rent this again. You know, that's what it was. It was the same case of Final Fantasy 3. It's like you realize you're not going to be able to beat that game in a weekend, and you're like, wow, I'm going to have to rent this again and again. I mean, if you think about it, go to any local video store, be if it's like, I don't know, a Mario World or a fighter or anything like that. You know, some of these that either don't have, you know, single player experience of adventures, and you have those over the weekend, like, yeah, you were designed as a kid to try and finish out of the weekend. And that was a really great moment when you're like, oh, I have to rent this again. I mean, your parents may not like it because they're throwing more money at you to rent it, but I found that a great experience because I was like, I knew what game I was going to get. And then, of course, the next Friday when I go to rent it, somebody else had rented it, and thus I couldn't do it.
Oh, man, yeah. I totally remember that, you know, and it's after a certain point, it's like, why don't you just buy the game? And, you know, of course, you're a kid. It's like, well, you know, give me more allowance. I will.
No, the worst was when you actually get really far into it. Like, okay, I'm going to return this. I'm going to get back Friday. Good. You know, you had save points on there, like three of them. Two were blank. One was yours. You get back. Yours is gone.
Yeah. it's true. I was thinking, sticking on Zelda. I was hearing kind of a silly argument a couple weeks back. Somebody knocking nostalgia, and they're like, you know, give me the original Zelda. I'll beat it in a few hours. Yeah, sure. You know, I will too. But, you know, get that game, you know, as a kid in the mid, late 80s, early 90s, whenever you played it, and tell me you're going to beat that in a couple hours without a walkthrough or a strategy guide by your side. There's no way. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, some of that, I don't know, it's just with certain games especially, you know, you need to put yourself in the context of the time they came out, you know, in relation to other things. It is, even with length, I mean, going way back, like, you know, I mean, look at the old Atari games. I mean, there was no story for most of them. They were single-player arcade experiences, yet people still love them. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of it is just, you know, is subjective, and I think for certain genres in particular, I think maybe people who weren't there in their heydays sort of missed the boat to some extent.
And maybe this is going back to like replayability a little bit, but one of the biggest things about like the original Legend of Zelda and, you know, what made it so popular is, yeah, you could beat it maybe in a couple hours, or maybe you beat it in 3 hours, but like you played it, and even though you're going from dungeon to dungeon, at a lot of points, it's still like it's a different experience from the last time you played it, you know. You know, maybe the monsters are like more aggressive, you know. Maybe you're having a bad luck with the monsters. Maybe you're not getting bomb drops. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's raining rupees or something like that. It's a different experience, and you have to approach it in a different way. Then all of a sudden, it's like a brand new game again to you.
Yeah. You know, we learned that when we were doing our playthrough. Yeah. We learned that when we'd have a great run, and then we'd do it again, and it would be bad.
Yeah, suddenly all the monsters, all their pockets are empty, and, you know, Link's going around, you know, begging for change. But it's that kind of stuff that made the game still exciting, and it still makes it exciting. I mean, nostalgia aside, you know, that's one of the major strengths of, like, you know, especially those early Legend of Zeldas.
Yeah, I liked your point a lot, Matt, about discovery. I think that's a huge reason why we all buy games, You know, we're being sold a promise, whether it's a trailer or something that says, hey, this is going to be different than anything else you've played before. And that's a big compelling reason why we buy games is, hey, wow, they have this crazy new type of Zelda game now. It's going to have all these new bosses or whatever it else is. I mean, you look like Xenoblade. You're like, hey, it's supposed to take 300 hours to beat this game. I wonder, you know, if it has compelling content for that time. You know, we're curious. We want to discover exactly what the world has in store for us. So yeah, I think discovery and that curiosity is a big reason why I get games. Yeah, I like that. And
I'm going to give talk a little bit more about Xenoblade Chronicles, and not X, but I will say, spoiler alert, Xenoblade Chronicles is still on my top spot for my favorite game of all times. Yeah. Sorry X didn't, you know, botch it at all. But the thing about Xenoblade Chronicles that I loved, it wasn't how big it was, it's that the game made me want to discover more about it. Like, I wanted to know more about the Bionis, because the story it gave me some stuff here and there, you know, but I wanted to know more. And, like, the side quest, you know, provided me a way to do that. Like, if you guys remember, I'm going to butcher this name. It's the bird people capital, Agnarithia.
Agnaratha.
I think that's it. And there were some missions there. They're like archaeology missions. Like, okay, we need you to go to this, you know, ruin and, you know, tell us what you find. And you pick up one thing and you send it to them. And then they go, oh, okay, so this means this and this means that. And I'm like, okay, so how's that connected to the rest of the world? Like, well, we got to go to the other side quest. I'm like, no, tell me now. Fine, I'll do the other side quest. And I was just like so eager to learn more about like what was going on and what that mystery was. And that game just sucked me right in. I've never seen a game be more successful at peddling side quests to me than Xenoblade Chronicles did.
It's very true.
Yeah, that reminds me too of them. Maybe Justin, you were talking about Metroid Prime, I think, and how I remember the first time I played that, I was kind of, you know, playing it like a traditional first-person shooter, which obviously it isn't, and then I'm like, oh, you know, I can scan here and I can scan there, and suddenly a game that didn't seem very, you know, story-driven, a lot of, you know, plot and mythology opened up, and I'm like, wow, you know, cool, you know, it's not forced at you, but, you know, it's there if you want it, and I think sometimes when people knock length or replayability, sometimes I wonder if they're taking advantage of all the game has to offer, whether it's story or extra modes, extra, you know, content, whatever. I think some people have the mentality, I want to get a game, beat it as quick as I can, and maybe trade it out, get another one. That's not my style, but some people do that.
Yeah, when you're mentioning as far as like with the scanning in Metroid Prime, it's like if you want to blast through the game, obviously you could use the scanning and go through and learn about the lore. I mean, to me, when you read through the lore, I feel like it's a bit of a sinister story when you think about it, if you read it all the way through. I mean, it may not be the strongest narrative out there, but it's still a good story, but subtly told. It's why I kind of like certain other games that don't really necessarily force feed you the story, in a sense. Two that come to mind were, you know, Half-Life 2, which was you could choose to ignore to listen to the NPCs while they told you in-game, or you could listen in on it. And another case was with Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, you know, and I could go on about that game exactly, as how wonderful it was and probably one of the better multi-platform aspects that Ubisoft ever did back then. And the story and conversations are usually told between you while you're climbing with your other NPCs, and yeah, it's a way to, I'm playing, but also being hearing the story as well. You know, it's not like, oh, here comes a cutscene, here comes this. I mean, yes, some games need to be cinematic, but there are ways to get around it by being cinematic, but not force-feeding. And like Trevor mentioned about scanning in Metroid Prime, yeah, there is that replayability, whatever. You go through doing it, you're like, oh, I wonder what I can get if I scan everything, you know, get everything I can, and that's what leads to that ending and such. And there's a lot of even humorous stuff in the scans that you can find if you get them all, even if they're not required.
And kind of going a little further than that, and you know, just to bring it back, I mentioned Xenoblade Chronicles was one of the best ways to tell a story, but Monolith Soft also has a game that had one of the worst ways to tell a story. We were talking about force feeding. And if anybody has ever played Xenogears, like the first one, I think I got the copy somewhere like that. That game, the first cutscene, I wish I could, you know, take you along. Oh, I'm sorry, not Xenogears, it's Xenosaga. Sorry, everybody.
Oh, wow.
This game right here.
That's yeah, one of the first few that Monolith Soft actually did outside of Square. Those games are, those games were infamous for having at least 30, 45-minute cutscenes, and I thought those were long until I played Metal Gear Solid 4 until the ending was like...
2 hours long.
Yeah.
I've heard about that, but, you know, as soon as I found out I was reviewing Xenoblade Chronicles X, my friend goes, hey, I've got a copy of Xenosaga, you should check it out. And so I did, and part of me is glad I had that experience in me, but the other part of me really wants those hours back.
I actually had that game back in the day, and I don't have it now. I sold it, I never beat it, and that probably indicates a lot of, in terms of the content. I mean, what makes a long game one you want to stick with versus one you're willing, you know, to get rid of without finishing? There's got to be some kind of an effective hook, and, you know, it is a challenge. You know, not everyone can do it.
And the what's worse is this game has the deadly combination of, we're going to have extremely lengthy cutscenes to show off graphics, but it's also the era of we're just trying to figure out voice acting in video games. Mm-hmm. And it's that perfect storm of hell where it's like you have to listen to like 40 minutes of just stale conversation or just awkward pauses and emphasis on like emotional emphasis where it doesn't make sense.
It's like voice acting with no voice direction, no voice director at all.
It felt like there was no voice direction.
just pretend something's there while you're voicing. Why not? Just go. Just imagine it.
Yeah. If you guys are DC animated fans, or mostly anything animated, you know Andrea Romano. She's the voice director for like Batman animated series, Batman Beyond, a bunch of animated shows out there, and pretty much everything I see her name on is done really well because she effectively, you know, tells the voice actors, hey, here's the emotion you're trying to convey here, you know, in this line, and here's what the other person is expecting you to feel, and you know, she just does a great job with, you know, her voice.
Unlike Batman and Bruce Wayne's own Kevin Conroy, because he's the one who's like, doesn't need direction because we all know he is Batman, and he is, I will go on to my grave saying this, the best Batman.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I just like talking about Xenosaga and then thinking about Xenoblade X and then all the connections started forming.
Uh-huh.
And then it's like, oh man. I didn't mention any of the connections in the review part one, but you could definitely, you're going to see a lot of things. If you played Xenosaga, you're going to see a lot of things in Xenoblade Chronicles X that look kind of familiar.
Nice. See, I was one when Xenoblade Chronicles X was still referred to as X, and, you know, the thing when I was like trying to like, oh, is this going to be Xenoblade Chronicles or a sequel, whatever, we weren't sure. And the first thought that came to me right before when they announced the title of it back in E3 2014, I thought it was just going to be like a sequel to Xenogears, the PS1 title that the members of Monolith Soft were with. And it had the same lettering with the Kings of the X, and I was like, this has to be it. And lo and behold, it's basically they're going the Final Fantasy route. Basically, it's not necessarily connected, but it's a spiritual successor to going forward. And but also, I think this is one that's taking a lot of nods from Xenosaga and Xenogears.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's doing that, I'll tell you that much. We appear to have strayed off topic a little bit.
A little bit.
That's all right. That's all right.
And I just wanted to move forward, and we talked about, you know, what you expect when you get, you know, the right amount of value out of your game. But can you guys think of a game now that's exceeded the value that you put into it? Like, you paid $60, and you got way more than $60. And I'm going to open this up to, like, the indie games, too, because we haven't been talking about them too much. But I'm sure there are definitely some indie games out there that, you know, have definitely exceeded the $20 or the $15 that you put into it.
I'm going to have to say, and it's a recent title, right? Well, I'm going to say two. And these are, a bit of a bias on here. They're both on Nintendo platforms, but I will say the ones that I feel like get more entertainment out of it just recently. One for the 3DS, I would have to say Fire Emblem Awakening, a title which, you know, took me around 50, 60 or so hours to fully complete. But even after you're done, you have some cheap DLC, but also other little, like, missions that you could go into and then recruit other members if you so choose. I feel like for the experience that I got out of there, even for $40, was well enough for a game that I felt was double the amount of time it took me to beat. Now, in terms of a Wii U title, one that just recently came out was Super Mario Maker. Now, given if you have an internet connection, that's the caveat there. Because if you have an internet connection, the world is open, basically, in terms of what types of Mario levels you want to explore or what you want to create. And I think, what was it, I forgot what the site said, whatever, when they were counting down, and this was way, way too early, it's like the current, like, well, the top 10 Wii U titles, and Mario Maker was number one on there. And they said if they were given the chance, like, to live on a desert island with an internet connect, oh, they would want a Wii U with Super Mario Maker with an internet connection. That's all they would want. And to me, that's what it really does. Mario Maker really, there's always something new to go for and new things to explore. And even if it's not meant as a multiplayer aspect game, you still have fun with people watching you want to build your levels. So that itself is like a good thing to green people out and even to just look forward and make anything you want to. To me, that's what Mario Maker does. It's a nice little level editing game that has no ends.
Mm-hmm. Mm, definitely.
Yeah, infinite replayability.
Mm-hmm. I guess for me, I mean, there's probably, you know, dozens of examples if I stopped and think about it, but two that I was playing this past week because we had friends down, both Wii U games would be Nintendo Land, Game and Wario. And the reason I'm also picking these examples, what I find interesting about them is their titles, even though they're a collection of different mini games. For both of them, there's a lot of the mini games I played just once, but there's some that are just so good. Like on Nintendo Land, a lot of them I've only played a couple times. But Mario Chase, I can play that every day for the rest of my life and have a blast. On Game & Wario, I can play their Pictionary game. And I mean, eventually words are going to repeat, but you know, those are my go-to group games with friends. And it doesn't matter that the other games are hit or miss because they're so strong. You know, even though by the standards we're talking about, it's not a rich content-filled game, but those two are so good and have, you know, replayability off the charts for me. It's well worth, Game & Wario, I think I got through Club Nintendo, so that might not be the best example, but Nintendo Land I actually bought, because it wasn't a pack-in for my Wii, I got Mario and Luigi U combo, and for whatever I paid for it, it was cheaper at the time, I think it was like, I don't know, maybe 30, but totally worth it, because if I was to click on see how many hours I've sunk into, it's off the charts, and mostly for those two particular, Mario Chase, Animal Crossing Sweetest Day. You know, they're just so much fun. So those are my examples.
Yeah, I would agree with Nintendo Land for sure. It was definitely a title I didn't expect to sink as much time as I did. But for one, the Zelda mini game was just awesome to play with friends on. I remember cruising through that and trying to, like, you get to some of the special levels. I don't want to spoil, you know, but there are some extra levels that you can get. Hopefully that's not too spoilerish, but
that's an older game now, so.
Yeah. So some of those are incredibly challenging, but incredibly satisfying, you know, getting through those. And there's a lot of teamwork involved with it. You know, sometimes I feel like playing with more people makes the game harder, so it makes it that much more satisfying when you actually beat it. Some of the enemies, like the Wizrobe or type of character, it'll send like the thing it shoots out at you at each person. So all four people that you're playing with have to be coordinated enough to reflect that attack back. Whereas if you're playing just by yourself, you can master it, you know, eventually. But getting four people to coordinate and get through the levels, that was probably one of the most fun I've had with the Wii U game cooperatively. But yeah, as far as like a 3DS title recently, I like the Puzzle and Dragons game.
I never did get a chance to get into that one. That was on my radar for it, but
yeah, it definitely surprised me. I had like zero expectations for it going in, but it definitely exceeded my expectations, and I got. I mean, I think it was only like a $30 game. I think it was $29.99. It may be a little cheaper now too, but it came in a little lower than some of the other 3DS games, and I've gotten a whole lot of value out of that if I played that 60 hours or more. I'm sure we could mention a ton of examples, especially if we go further back in our systems. I mean, GoldenEye is probably one that we all got, you know, way more, you know, money's worth. And Smash Brothers Melee is probably another huge one where I played hundreds of hours.
My friend, at one of my work, where we were getting a discussion, which game did you put the most hours into? And one he mentioned, I think, I forgot what RPG it was, can't think of the type, but he asked me, and it was like, well, the one game I put up many hours into was Super Smash Bros. Melee. He's like, how many hours? But like, I don't know, it's like, I said close to 200, because I could not stop playing that game, aside from maybe either Metroid Prime or even the Wind Waker. It's like, but I was just wanting to unlock everything in Melee as quickly as possible and just master the characters that I had on there. And then I lost my memory cards and everything was gone. But I did recently find them when I was cleaning out my parents' house when they were getting all my stuff. And I was like, oh, what's this? My GameCube stuff. And I was like, yes! My black, my little black black memory card. It's all here.
So. Memory card 251.
Yeah.
That was the best.
Nice. I think, too, you reminded me. I'm sorry. I just wanted to, we don't have to spend time on it, but Justin made a good point that I was thinking, too. We all love it when a game we're totally hyped for lives up to, like, you know, Zelda, Xenoblade, Mario, whatever. But I love it when Justin's like, you go into a game with no expectations, and then it blows you away. For me, in some respects, that's even better than having a game I'm hyped for, because it's a complete surprise in the best way possible.
That's what I'm expecting with Xenoblade Chronicles X. It's someone as me who everybody's asking me, I bought a guide, and I've watched all the survival guide videos that Nintendo America's put out. But I'm going in basically saying, okay, I know I'm going to dedicate a lot of time to this.
Yeah.
It's going to be overwhelming. But I know with a lot of patience, I'm able to actually get worth it. Because I think everybody said, once you get the scales, it's a real big game changer.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, oh, I'm excited.
Oh, I already said too much.
It changes the game, spoiler!
Oh, no! Ruined.
You mean you get some special item? Ah.
Terrible.
Turns out it's the Monado.
Yeah. Some enemies become friends, some friends become enemies.
Alright. So I guess I have like two answers. Technically I have three answers. You brought up Melee, and I just remembered. My Melee desk no longer works because I spent so many hours, me and my friends put so many hours into it. No, it's just unreadable now, so.
Well, maybe we'll get that released on the Wii U Virtual Console, since Nintendo promised us GameCube games. Oh wait.
Oh wait, yeah, never.
You know what? I think I'm fine with the latest iteration of Smash Brothers.
Oh no, I'm perfectly happy. This is people. I will say each version of Smash gets better, even though the last version, Brawl, was not meant really well for the competitive scene.
Mm-hmm.
Brawl got was better because as far as content that was in there, even though, but with Smash 4, to me, I feel like that's one that's able to balance everything for people who are casual and those who want this to be like the competitive scene, and I feel like it's a nice little return to form to it. And that's, well, ever since I lost my roommates, I haven't been playing as much, but once the new characters come out, yes, I'm going to jump back into it, and thankfully the online portion of it's a little bit more smoothed out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, my two answers. I'm gonna give the first regular answer, and then I'll give the cop out answer. Okay. The regular answer actually is not a Nintendo game at all. It's actually Mega Man Legends 2 for the original PlayStation. And I say that because I poured $60 into that game in 2013. So I went online and bought that game, which is luckily I did. I was like, I got to pull the trigger because the first game I play, I have Mega Man 64 for, you know, well, the Nintendo 64, which is Mega Man Legends and PlayStation. And that game, you know, so ensnared me. And I was like, I knew there was a sequel out there. I had to play it. And I knew it was expensive. One day the price just went down. I was like, all right, got to do it. Got it. Luckily I got it because later on it was like $300. Mm-hmm. Absolutely blown away for an early play for like a no, it's a late PlayStation game. That's right. It's the voice acting is better than Xenosaga. It's better than that already. It ages extremely well for a PlayStation 1 game, and the difficulty is very balanced. That you know the characters are pretty compelling. You want to know more about the story. You know it unfolds well. The pacing is great, and I think I poured like 80 so hours into it, and I've replayed it so many times already. And, you know, in this modern day, I've played it, and the fact that the game holds that well up that well for me, a game of which I have no nostalgia for, you know, that says a whole lot about that, you know.
Mm. That's a good point, yeah.
Okay, time for my cop-out answer. Xenoblade Chronicles, of course, obviously. Well, I guess I couldn't say that because it wasn't my $60. It was my friend's $60 that I got money out of.
What did you just say? What did you just, like, threaten him? Just, like, buy me this game now.
No, he didn't. Like, he just let me borrow the game.
Oh, okay.
And he's like, here, you need to play through it. And that was, like, spring of 2013. And then all of a sudden, you know, winter of 2014 comes and he goes, hey, you come and get my game back anytime soon? I'm like, oh, hold on. I just got to figure out this one side quest. I think I got it all figured out now.
Have you purchased your own copy now, Matt? Or?
No.
I'm your friend, Matt. It's the same thing, except my buddy's had it for over a year now, I think. And I told him, I said, you know, the new one's coming out in like, you know, I told him like a week ago. I'm like, it's coming out any day. Are you almost done with it?
Oh. I'll never be done.
That's so funny. That's so funny.
I mean, part of it's like a good game, but I'll have to admit, part of it is because I am very bad at borrowing games. For example, this is a visual gag, but, you know.
Hey, that looks familiar.
What? Oh, no.
When did I send that to you?
Oh, man, I don't know.
Look at that really old Electronic Arts logo, whatever, before it was just the simple smile. That's
classic.
For those who don't know, or for those who are listening to the audio podcast, thank you for listening to our audio podcast. Also, I held up a copy of Overblood for the PlayStation 1 that I borrowed from Trevor at least a year or so ago. I remember because I played it at my friend's place and he had an apartment. Now he has a house. That's how much time has passed.
Wow.
It's funny you mentioned loaning things. I have a program on a computer that helps me keep track of that. So if I loan a game out, it'll have reminders. It'll say who I loaned it to, and you can, you know, it's kind of a cool thing because it keeps track of what's in your game library, but also what you've rented out. And say, hey, you've rented this out. You can know this person still has it.
I mean, every day I'm aware that I still have it. I just haven't given it back.
Well, as long as you think you'll eventually get to it, you can hang on to it for a while.
I'll probably play it again here at some point. This game is valuable to me in a completely different way, in that it's just so bad, it's good.
Mm. Some games are like that, and I think somehow people, I don't know, they sort of diminish sometimes that people can like games that are legitimately bad, as if, you know, our own nostalgia or feelings are somehow less than like graphics or whatever. And I mean, I've got plenty of games like that. It gets tricky sometimes if I'm reviewing a game like that, because I'm like, I know this game's bad, but I'm still having fun with it. What do I do? I have to stop and think about how I'm going to do that. But yeah, there's some genuinely, I'm sure we all have them, genuinely bad games that we just love.
I know Justin does.
Typical.
We just, you guys ever play Ninja Bread Man for the Wii?
No, yeah. I've seen it. That looks like garbage.
It is garbage, absolutely. But talk about value. I picked up a copy for 99 cents. The night we beat it in like 2 hours. It has like three levels, but for the amount of laughter and memories I got playing that with friends, there's a game that's well exceeded the 99 cents I paid. It was so much fun. In for being such a terrible game. So
Trevor, I know you
here's my confession. What's that?
I know you're talking about like, you know, finding valuable games are bad, but I'm starting to see a trend here. I've got your copy of Overblood. You've got a copy of Ninja Bread Man. You think they're both great. What's going on here?
My name's Trevor, and I'm addicted to bad games.
No.
I have a problem.
No, is this the part where I'm just like, well, I have this, and I just hold up a copy of Wii Music, and it's just like, oh, hey. Yeah.
Allow me to fulfill that role for you.
Oh.
Matt will defend Wii Music.
Matt will.
I have defended Wii Music.
Yes. It's KubaCats 40-something.
Yeah, I've got it.
I will, okay, you may defend Wii Music, but I will not defend that Wii Music presentation at E3 back in 2008. Where what's his face with the like the awkward drumming?
DJ Ravi drums. This is high concept. Advertising right there.
That was my first E3 and my first Nintendo press conference. So I'm looking at it with a little nostalgia glasses, but I don't remember it being that bad. I was like, oh, cool, Shawn Clyde, and you know, I don't know if I just blacked out when DJ Ravi was up there, but. I don't remember DJ Rock, like seeing the gifs and stuff later on where he's going to town. I'm like, I don't remember that guy.
See what they probably did. They pumped in some gas into the Nokia Theater and they made sure, like, do you remember anything? What? I don't remember that at all. They wanted you to make sure they didn't remember that. I think that's why Nintendo doesn't do press conferences there anymore because they got caught in their ass.
Drug-induced nostalgia. It's still nostalgia, right?
That's right.
I was recently watching because I was doing research for a cover story, and I was recently watching a bunch of Nintendo E3 announcements, you know, when they announced the new 3DS or the 3DS, the Wii U and the Wii and stuff like that. And I look at that stuff, especially like, say, the 3DS, I look at that and how they handled it or how they handled, you know, when the DS came out, and then I go, and this is the same company that kind of pulled out Wii Music, and that was like one of their headline events. It's like, what happens? What goes through their heads? Like, this is the great thing. And then they just completely, it's like a switch. It's like, amazing, or we're going to make fun of it for the rest of your days.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you can go back to like 2004, I mean, with Twilight Princess, and they showed off the Capcom 5, and I mean, that was a killer show.
Ooh, the Capcom 5, that brings back memories.
Yeah. Well, and then you fast forward to, what was it, the Nintendo Land press conference where they're like, hey, we got a lot of games to get to, and literally like the last 30 minutes was them talking about Nintendo Land when they crammed like, you know, 15 other games into like 1 minute each or whatever it was. It's like, it's like this is the same company that planned this conference.
And it didn't seem to get much better after that when they ditched the whole press conferences thing, because I went in the year after that, and they had a couple announcements here and there, but they were mostly talking about 3D Land, and Miyamoto was up there. He was wearing cat ears, and so was Onuma. And then they locked the doors and trapped us in the E3 showroom floor for 30 minutes because they had a giant announcement.
Yeah,
which was Wii Fit Trainer was coming for the Wii Smash Brothers.
It's honestly been a lot better just doing the directs because they can figure out what works and what doesn't before they disseminate it, you know.
Oh, they do, but I will say probably I would ask them to. I mean, because those kind of type of things are expensive to do, especially renting out. But not to say Nintendo doesn't have money; they just feel like money's best spent elsewhere. Yeah. But if you're unveiling like a console, like say whenever it'd be at the NX, I feel like that'd be a wise thing to return to. But yeah. I don't know.
Hopefully they do return to something, some physical show for NX reveal. Mm-hmm. Getting back to game value stuff, the value of games and things. We talked briefly about indie games, but one thing I guess I always go back to. You know, it could be an indie game, it could be a AAA game, but, you know, if it's got good content and the price isn't, like, you know, overly exorbitant where it's, you know, you see some indie games that are like $20, and there's a lot of indie games that warrant that. There's some indie games that are $5 that could easily be $20 or $30. So I feel like in obviously perfect scenarios, an indie developer would charge exactly what they need to make a good profit and to make a good product. Sometimes development goes longer, and I think, you know, it's not necessarily a better game, but they're charging more because they need to recoup the cost that they put into the game. So I think there are some examples of that, but in a perfect scenario, when you have a really good indie game that comes out, it's because it's, you know, got great content, the price is right, and, you know, the developers are happy and the fans are happy. So,
yeah, I'm definitely a big believer in like content reflective of the price. Mm-hmm. You know, as somebody who's like reviewed a lot of budget games, you know, if I'm playing a $1.99 game, I'm not expecting an epic. And yet I can appreciate it when like a game like that, you know, has things like, say, online leaderboards or controller customization or things like that. And then I play more expensive games and they're lacking these sort of features. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, how come these cheap games are pulling these things off and, you know, these other ones aren't? So
I think it has to come down to when you have, like, a cheap title, like, looking far as, like, something like us on mobile, is that as far as the price that are reflected for, like, something that's, like, 99 cents or $1.99, is that these developers of these games, you know, they know that vast majority of people have these, you know, all these out there that they're willing that if we get even 100,000 people to buy that, mm-hmm. that at least can cover our costs for this game. I mean, they know as far as what it's going to go to it, but not to say that that should be like, oh, we should lack as far as like give you what's enough for 99 cents, but more like, hey, get a good experience out of 99 cents, even if it feels like a $15 experience. I mean, I don't even know, like, there's a, take for instance, Fast Racing Neo is going to be priced at $15. I think they just announced that today or believe whatever, and it's coming out next week on the eShop. That is one I'm interested in seeing as far as content. We'll have maybe as far as racing content, say on par of Zero GX. That's one thing I'm trying to think about because I got my money's worth out of that, but mostly because I was insane and I thought, hey, I'm going to jump up in the higher difficulties on there and try and beat this out. And part of my soul died when I did that. I mean, I almost broke one GameCube controller for doing that. So
that was an intense game.
Oh God, it was.
but yeah, like yeah, with Fast Racing Neo, I think that's priced, you know, pretty fair, especially when you see a lot of the indie games that are 2D platformers. They're, you know, it's fairly run of the mill. They're obviously trying to do things to differentiate themselves from other platformers, but the Fast Racing Neo does definitely stand out amongst the indie masses, and $15. You know, I've seen some other ones that have been priced more for less, I think. And so hopefully, like what we're talking about with Mario Kart, no single player. It's essentially a multiplayer only game for $60. We still get tons of value for it, or I would say most people would see a good return on that price. So hopefully, $15. Got 16 courses. Hopefully it's got some good compelling multiplayer. Hopefully it has some good legs to it.
Yeah. You made a good point too about being 3D. I think it was Matt and I were talking about it when we were doing the Let's Talk Indie thing. You know, how many eShop games, you know, especially those at more, you know, lower end prices try to tackle 3D environments, 3D worlds. You know, most of them do 2D. Part of it's nostalgia, but a lot of it is, you know, too, I think, you know, cost factor. So that's why I kind of get intrigued when I see 3D games, even if they don't turn out great, I can admire that, you know, ambition.
Yeah.
So that probably reflects, too, in, you know, in pricing.
All right. And I think with that, I'm going to go ahead and start to wrap up this KoopaCast. I want to thank all of our readers for, you know, reading our magazine and our website, all of our listeners for listening to our audio podcast, and all the watchers for watching our other YouTube videos and watching this KoopaCast. And if you would like to see more KoopaCast episodes or other content, you can always go to our YouTube page, youtube.com/purenintendo. If you want to see more news, reviews, or features, you can always go to purenintendo.com. And if you want to check out our bi-monthly digital magazine, you can do that as well. You can go to purenintendo.com. If you click on, I believe, PNM, you can go check it out there. Excuse me. If you have any questions for the KoopaCast, you can always email us at podcast@purenintendo.com. You can also interact with us on Twitter. We love talking to our fans. As you can see, about 50% of us have our Twitter handles below our names and our banners.
How do you get that? I want that, even though I'm...
it's podcast magic.
Yeah.
It's too complicated to go into here.
We'll get you on.
This seems...
there's a little custom overlay at Google has you. I don't know, man. We'll find some.
Ruining the magic. But as you can see, I'm at purely Matt, or purely underscore Matt. Justin is at purely underscore Justin. Trevor is at T Gould 81.
No. It's at Trev underscore G1, I believe. And I got to say, even though my banner is inaccessible, I think I have more Twitter followers than either of you, so.
Oh, so it's a competition.
I don't mean to brag, guys. No.
All right, and
but I always redirect people to Pure Nintendo, so I really don't tweet much of anything else. So.
The only thing I tweet aside from video games is just basically my St. Louis sports teams. That's it. And some are good and some are bad. Yeah.
And if you want to hear more about your St. Louis sports teams, what Twitter handle would they have to follow?
My only Twitter to handle, it's all one word. It's H Milfeld, HMILFELD, as in dog. And you can follow me on there. I've been talking more and more gaming. Like, it's just like, it's more to kind of grow that audience, but also good at networking. And if it's a nice little thing where I just try to keep myself clean. But you're gonna see me probably talking a little bit more during about the Game Awards, whatever it's gonna be unveiled for Nintendo tomorrow. So.
Oh yeah.
And all of us together are at Pure Nintendo. Mm-hmm. All right, and with that, we will see you all in 2 weeks for yet another KoopaCast.
Hi, everyone.
There you go.